Thank you. Thank you for my introduction. It's a great pleasure and honour to be here. I say it's a pleasure. I have to get very early to be here, and I don't normally speak to other human beings before midday. But it is certainly, it is certainly an honour. I should say I'm a bit surprised I was asked to do this, because I have a reputation for being self-referential and a bit polemic. So this will be no exception, this lecture. So the important thing is not to take me too seriously or anything I say. The agenda of this presentation is just to survey the sorts of computational or conceptual tools that computational science has to offer in terms of trying to understand psychiatric disorders. So I'm going to do that by providing a worked example that allows one to or illustrates the sorts of approaches that one can take. And the worked example, the case study I'm going to take is schizophrenia. The work and the ideas that I'm going to talk about are going to be reprised in one form or another throughout the course. So I'm going to go through this quite quickly, again, just to survey for you the sorts of things that one can do. A lot of the ideas will be unpacked in greater detail and more slowly later on. So I'm going to rush through this, but don't worry about that. There will be plenty of opportunity to catch up and go into some of these issues more deeply later on. So let's start with schizophrenia. So I've listed here the symptoms and signs of schizophrenia. I just want to focus on the symptoms, delusions, hallucinations, and thought disorder, and ask you a question, or ask myself a question. What are we trying to explain? And I guess we're trying to explain, in this instance, in this example, the symptoms. Now, can anybody spot one canonical aspect of all those symptoms? What do they all have in common? Let's go through it. Got delusions, false beliefs, delusional systems, hallucinations, false percepts, thought disorder, loosening of associations, disintegration of the psyche, as coined by Bleuler. What do they all have in common? You. What one thing?
Abnormality.
Of what? I will be asking questions, and you remember stuff more acutely. Have you got your hand up?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, abnormality of information processing.
Yes. Yep. Do you want to expand on that? Information processing. What's information?
Input information from the outer world, like the processing of those in the inner representation.
Yeah, inner representation. So the inner representations would be the product of that processing. The word I'm trying to coerce you to say is beliefs or inference. So that, absolutely, abnormalities of beliefs or the results of processing of information. So that's, from the perspective of this talk, the common aspect, the thing that we're trying to explain and understand. Aberrant beliefs and false inference. Inference being the formation of representations that are the results of processing information. So that's the game. And in fact, if you think about it, there are very, very few symptoms of any psychiatric disorder that cannot be cast in terms of false inference or aberrant beliefs. And I've just listed a few here. You could just go on and on and on. So the game then is to try and understand using computational tools how false inference or aberrant beliefs arise, and how possibly they could lead to some of the signs of schizophrenia or psychosis, such as psychomotor poverty and soft neurological signs. And we'll come back to those later on in terms of abnormal eye movements and things like abnormal oddball responses. So that's the thing we're trying to explain. Now, I just want to quickly look at the sorts of theories on offer that might help us understand or point to the neurobiological substrate or abnormalities that lead to that false inference. So on the left, I've listed a few of these sort of physiological or pathophysiological theories of schizophrenia, and on the right, some of the more etiological ones. Now again, a question. What is common to the dopamine hypothesis, subsuming abnormal plasticity, abnormal salience or aberrant salience, glutamate hypothesis implicating MDR, receptor function, abnormal synchrony or oscillations that implicate NMDR receptors, and indeed inhibitory interneurons, the GABAergic hypotheses, abnormal gain control, theories of normal cortical excitation inhibition balance. What have all these things got in common? This is a survey of all the theories of schizophrenia. What is the common denominator?
Neurotransmitter.
Are you allowed to answer? You're the course organisers. Yes, they certainly have in common the fact that they all pertain to abnormal neurotransmitters. What is peculiar about these transmitters, though? What is special about them? Anybody? Well, they're all neuromodulators. They are all involved in not necessarily transmitting information, but contextualizing or modulating the excitability of cells in the brain. Okay? So, what we have here is a simple summary of all the current and past pathophysiological theories of schizophrenia. They all speak to aberrant neuromodulation and synaptic gain control. So they don't, these neurotransmitters or, and these effects, for example, abnormal synchrony or aberrant synchrony, they do not in themselves cause postsynaptic responses, but they modulate those responses in response to presynaptic input. So given those two facts, well, those two postulates that we have to explain abnormal inference and that the likely cause of that is an abnormal gain control, what sort of computational theories would you consider fit for purpose in pursuing that agenda? So what computational... Does anybody have a favourite computational theory? You. What's your... No, don't look away. Lady in the red jacket. What's your favourite computational theory? You have a favourite. That's very Catholic of you. Who does have a favourite? I will ask the course organisers. No, I can't. They'll just be polite and say the free energy principle. Apart from the free energy principle, I'll pick on you again. What's your favourite? What's your favourite?
I dislike them all.
You dislike. Perfect. Could you tell me the one you dislike the most, then? I won't embarrass you, but I think it's important to realise you have a choice here. There are a number of theories that you could subscribe to. You could choose the supervisor who is an expert in that theoretical domain. So you need to think about the sorts of theories that are on offer. And I've listed... let me just reverse. What I wanted to emphasise here, that conclusion that the pathophysiology of psychosis reduces to abnormal gain control and faulty, if you like, transistors in the brain is a very, very old idea. And I just wanted to contrast two particular perspectives on the implicit disconnection that you're talking about when you're breaking the modulation of the sensitivity of neural elements. So this fundamental distinction between an anatomical breach of connectivity, a disconnection of a Gershwin or a Wernicke's sort, was first relative to a more subtle functional disconnection that is mediated at the synaptic level. That can be traced right back to the positions adopted respectively by Wernicke and Bleuler. So the anatomical disconnection is known as the subjunction hypothesis. So this is a disconnection of the organs of connectivity, an abnormality in the wires or the white matter. What we are talking about is not that. What we are talking about is a more subtle disconnection or abnormal gain control that speaks more to the notion of the disintegration of the psyche that would be, if you like, metaphorically understood in terms of breaking a radio by introducing faults into the neurotransmitters. Yeah?
Sorry, it's just really quiet in the back. I can't really hear.
Haven't you heard anything we've said so far?
No, not at all.
Oh, I'm sorry. So we were just rehearsing the distinction between anatomical disconnections, perspectives on psychosis of the sort articulated by Wernicke, known as the subjunction hypothesis, and the more subtle functional disconnections implicated or implied by theories of abnormal gain control in the cortex. And I was just making the point that that's more similar to Laurie's original description of the disintegration of the psyche. And metaphorically, if you're going to break a radio, you can break it in two ways. You can cut the wires, or you can break the transistors, and the transistors are the gain control mechanism. So I'm just pointing out that everything that we're saying here has been said a century ago. But what I wanted to, what I thought I was talking about was the computational theories that you might bring to the table to try and understand false inference and this disintegration of the psyche. So I've listed here, along with the proponents, some of the things you might appeal to: reinforcement learning, optimal control theory, expected utility theory, information theory, principle of maximum mutual information or minimum redundancy. This would be the information processing perspective. Self-organization and synergetics, dynamics, autopoiesis, allostasis, understanding the brain as a dynamical system. Or finally, the Bayesian brain, Bayesian decision theory, and predictive coding. Now, can anybody think of any other computational theories of the brain? Anyone? Good, then I will take that as that we then have a comprehensive list of all the theories that we could appeal to. So of those, which is fit for purpose to address the fundamental question of how abnormal beliefs arise in the brain? Anybody? It's a slightly contrived question, obviously. Anybody want to have a guess? You, sir.
Maybe the bottom one.
Really? Can I congratulate you on your choice? Yes, of course. You're not going to explain hallucinations with reinforcement learning or expected utility theory. All right? So I'm not saying that that is not an appropriate theory, and you will see a lot of reinforcement learning. But from our perspective, the only theory that that will accommodate false beliefs are those theories that actually deal explicitly with beliefs, and in this instance, Bayesian beliefs, probabilistic representations. We've heard about information processing, the formation of representations. We're talking about probabilistic representations that in Bayesian decision theory and the Bayesian brain hypothesis correspond to Bayesian beliefs. So that's what we're going to look at. So I'm now going to take you briefly through the sorts of Bayesian brain hypotheses that we could use, and then show how one can use those theories to illustrate the formation of abnormal beliefs and illustrate simulations, hallucinations and delusions, and speak to some of those softer neurological signs or other signs of schizophrenia in terms of how false inference can be caused by an abnormality of gain control that's sympathetic to the disintegration of the psyche implied by abnormal gain control. So predictive coding, the Bayesian brain. For those of you familiar with my talks, you will know exactly where this is going. I'll go through it very briefly. So the Bayesian brain can normally be articulated using the words of Hermann Helmholtz, nicely summarised here as objects are always imagined as being present in the field of vision, as would have to be there in order to produce the same impression on the nervous mechanism. So what he's saying is that these formation of beliefs are essential in order to perceive. To do the information processing, you have to have a hypothesis or an explanation for the causes of your sensations, and that is the belief that we're talking about. This is very similar to the theories of Richard Gregory and subsequent developments in computational neuroscience machine learning that exploits these ideas in terms of the Helmholtz machine, as championed by people like Peter Diane, Jeffrey Hinton, borrowing from Bayesian theory and other variational work. But I just want to make this very simple. because what we're just looking at is what do the forms of the information processing that are mandated by this perspective, this Bayesian brain perspective, what do these forms have to tell us about the possible ways in which false beliefs can arise? So I'm going to quickly survey predictive coding, Bayesian filtering. What we have here are... So this is just a mathematical description of how representations or expectations in the brain are formed in terms of a prediction that is updated in relation to prediction error. So what's prediction error? Well, let's assume that we have this sensory input here, this sensory impression, this shadow on our sensory organs or our retina here. So the idea is that we're going to generate a hypothesis or expectation about the causes of these sensations, this information here, and generate a prediction of the sensations, and then simply measure the discrepancy or the prediction error to form a prediction error here. And if we can minimise this prediction error, then we have a sufficient explanation or belief about the causes of our sensations. And this expression here is just a mathematical expression of a gradient descent on the sum of square prediction error, weighted by the precision or the inverse variance of the prediction errors. So if I were now to minimise prediction error, then I would have a sufficient explanation for things in the world causing my sensations or the way that I sample them. That explanation doesn't have to be the correct one. It just has to minimise the prediction error. And you will never know the difference. And you never need to know the difference if you can always minimise your prediction error. So that's quite nice, because that lends itself to a very simple understanding of action perception. They're both in the service of minimising prediction error. We can either change the neuronal activity in our brain to make our predictions more like our sensations, or we can resample the world by moving around, moving our sensory organs or changing the world itself to make our predictions come true and make sensations fulfil what we predicted they would be. And that's a nice description of action. So very, very simple view of action and perception and behaviour and choice. It's all in the game of minimising prediction error. Now, you have another choice now. If you've chosen the Bayesian brain hypothesis, you now have another choice. The choice here pertains to something called generative models. So if we are minimising prediction error, we have to have predictions. If we have predictions, then we have to have a model of the world that can generate those predictions. So one fundamental distinction between the different models that we could subscribe to is whether we are dealing with causes that are continuous in nature, like the intensity of a visual stimulus or the motion of a flying bird or its song, for example, or whether we're in a world that can be described in terms of discrete states. I am in position one, as labelled in a little grid world, or I am in a categorical state. Now, the same principles apply identically to both, and in fact, the Bayes optimal solutions that you'll get in terms of predictions and subsequent behaviour through action or sampling the world under both of these generative models are formally exactly the same. The way that you get there, though, is slightly different, but what we're looking for are commonalities or distinctions that will allow us to choose which is the most appropriate model. Just for those of you who are more mathematically minded, this equation here, which we had in the previous slide, if we actually solve that, what we end up is something called a Bayesian belief update. And these are the solutions to the Bayes optimal expectations about hidden causes or states of the world under this discrete state space model. So technically, this is known as Bayesian filtering or predictive coding in neurobiology and engineering. Technically, this is known as variational Bayes or empirical Bayesian learning. But actually, they're both optimizing the same thing, and they both actually formally have a lot of commonalities. So here's a generative model where we have hidden causes cascading down hierarchically to generate sensory predictions or sensory information. And here we have the equivalent sort of state-based model, which some of you will recognise as a Markov decision process. So a choice to be made here, and you will see examples of both in over the next couple of days. I'm going to focus on the continuous time, just to show you how far you can go in terms of simulating and understanding the positive symptoms that we're talking about before. But more importantly, I repeat, we're trying to locate where the pathophysiology could lie, where it's located, and then understand how that pathophysiology can lead to the false beliefs that we're trying to explain. So here's a simple generative model where we're generating, when we say, in this instance, generating retinal input on the basis of a saccadic sampling of an object. But in order to generate predictions of that input, we have to know what we're looking at and where we're sampling it from. And we combine those things hierarchically high in the visual system in order to generate beliefs, representations of what the causes of our sensory samples, that then actually make predictions about the sensory input, and then those would be compared with the actual sensory input and used to update those expectations at higher levels. And I've just cartooned that here. This equation actually describes this reciprocal or recurrent message passing between hierarchical levels of a generative model, where in brief we have these descending predictions generating predictions of expectations at different levels of the hierarchical model, forming predictions or mismatches or discrepancies that are then passed up to revise or update Bayesian expectations or beliefs at the higher level. So the whole system, through reciprocal message passing, eliminates and reduces prediction errors at all levels of the model, providing a parsimonious explanation of the causes of sensory input that has many different levels of hierarchical abstraction. So that's the basic model that we're going to be using. I'll just rehearse that one more time intuitively using visual sampling as an example. So here are equations slightly unpacked here. So these are the precision-weighted prediction errors. Precision, I remind you, being the inverse of variability or the reliability or the confidence you can place in different prediction errors, that are the difference between the top-down predictions and the expectations at any level. So, for example, we could have retinal input here being predicted by visual descending predictions to form prediction error that's passed up the hierarchy to revise our expectations at the level of V1. But these expectations are themselves being predicted by top-down, more abstract representations or expectations, and themselves have a high-level prediction error that's passed up to revise those expectations so that prediction error is minimised at all levels. The key thing from the point of view of behaviour and choice is to remember that we do not just have access to sensory information of a visual sort, but also about our own bodies, both in terms of proprioception and interoception. And these have to be predicted as well. And we could indeed change our beliefs about where we were looking in order to make our proprioceptive predictions or the information about the stretching of our oculomotor system or to reduce prediction errors about the state of our oculomotor system. However, here's the important thing. These prediction errors can actually reduce themselves directly by coupling back to the environment to actually change the signals, the prediction, the sensory information itself, simply by stretching or not various muscles, so that you're making the top-down prediction come true through classical reflexes. So all we're talking about is action and perception under predictive coding with reflexes, and that's the basic model that I'm going to pursue. Just to remind you, there is an alternative computational formulation of this sort of approach to understanding brain function. And that's the NDP sort of scheme with this variational Bayesian updating. The commonality, actually, that I want to emphasise is, again, this role of precision. So if you remember here, this is our message passing scheme, and precision acts by acting as a gain control or a modulator of the prediction errors. And, of course, that precision itself has to be estimated. It has to be optimized so that it minimizes the precision weighted prediction error. And I'm going to use sort of this cyan bluey color to indicate the precision here. And here it's modulating the sensitivity of this particular population of error units. Exactly the same mathematical formalism emerges under the discrete state space of Markov decision process models. What we have in this particular example is a precision weighting of policies or expectations or beliefs about particular policies that could emerge. And in this particular context, the precision weighting enters a softmax function. So for those of you familiar with softmax functions, precision is simply the inverse temperature or the sensitivity. So it's the same thing mathematically. I'm not going to be talking about the MDP's Markov decision process formulation, but you might hear about that to a certain extent in later lectures. I'm going to pursue the predictive coding and conclude with a series of illustrations based largely upon Rick Adams's work here that speak to a key thing that Chris will talk about in depth in the next lecture, and that's this hierarchical balance of the precision or the gain control that was implicated by all the pathophysiological theories of psychosis and schizophrenia. So the idea here is very simple. It's just that there is precision or gain control operating at each hierarchical level from the sensory to the higher, more abstract levels in the cortical hierarchy, and that the balance between the increase in the precision at the higher levels, giving you more confidence in your top-down predictions, your prior beliefs about what's causing the sensations, relative to the sensory precision, will have a profound effect on inference. And if you break that, then you have a potential explanation for many of the sorts of signs and symptoms that we've been talking about. And the idea will be that there is a failure of this balance, either in terms of too much precision at the low level or too little precision at the higher level, or compensation for the reduction in precision at the higher level, leading to the notion that you've got an imbalance that the brain tries to compensate for. And we have written this down here in terms of decompensation, where there is a failure of precise high-level beliefs resulting in an abnormal and weak top-down prediction of sensory input that leads to many of the trait abnormalities in psychosis that can be compensated for by a compensatory increase in high-level precision leading to the psychotic state. And what we'll do very briefly is just show how that single hypothesis that borrows from, or in fact is prescribed by, the form of belief updating under the Bayesian brain hypothesis can account for all sorts of things like attenuated violation responses, abnormal eye movements, psychomotor poverty, hallucinations and delusions. So let me just now finish by just taking you very swiftly through a series of simulations of all of these symptoms and signs, just as a way of illustrating how one can use computational neuroscience to get into the mechanics of aberrant belief formation. So I'm going to start off with one of my favourite examples, which is birdsong. And what we've done here... Oh, okay. Now, if you can't hear me, you're not going to hear this. So be very quiet. Okay. I can hear it. Did anybody hear it at all? All right. So little birds singing. And it's just built... I won't go into the details. We just use two Lorentz attractors where a slow one provides control parameters to a faster one, and the faster one generates amplitude and frequency modulated information. And then the predictive coding scheme tries to work out the state of the high-level attractor. And this leads to a nice metaphor for the information processing of birdsong in a songbird. And here we have the sonogram outputs and the perception, the expectations and the prediction errors driving dynamically these belief updates in this message passing scheme. But what I want to do is just to show, well, make the point very simply, that if you've got a little synthetic brain that conforms to the principles that you have said you want to use to understand how the brain works, then you can go in and do simulated lesions and ask questions. What would happen if? So what would happen if we broke the balance between high and low level precision, prior and sensory precision? Well, I'm going to do that in the context of an oddball response simulation. So I'm presenting this song to a bird, but I'm abruptly discontinuing the stimulus after a series of chirps. So I'm omitting an expected chirp. And what I'm hoping to see in the normal predictive coding scheme is a strong violation response in terms of lots of prediction error, because the bird thought that there's going to be a particular chirp and it doesn't happen. There's going to be a massive prediction error response that will quickly revise its beliefs about whether the song is still in play or not. And indeed, that is exactly what happens. So at the point that the stimulus was terminated, there's a massive prediction error here, and we can liken that to, say, a mismatch negativity response in electrophysiological research. Now, I'm going to break the balance, and I'm going to do that by reducing the precision at the higher level. So now, the bird can't make confident predictions, and that is reflected, for example, in the failure to recognise this chirp or predict this chirp, which means that there's a prediction error even during the expected presentation of the song, which causes a revision. It gets back on track again. But because the predictions are now less precise, this early prediction error means that the difference between the prediction error due to the omission and the prediction error in the absence of omission is attenuated. And then if we looked at the waveform differences between, say, standards and oddball responses, we would see a vastly attenuated mismatch negativity. And this is one of the hallmarks of one of the few reproducible electrophysiological signs of schizophrenia is an attenuated mismatch negativity or oddball or violation response. So this is what the normal bird... Oh, you can't hear, can you? No, never mind. So this is the normal bird. I'll just do it for my own pleasure. That's the... when we reduce the gain at the higher level, or we induce an imbalance, what we lead to is a failure to recognise violations. It's an interesting insight. What it means is, if you've got this failure, so you have schizophrenia, that means that everything is mildly surprising. Your whole world is mildly surprising all the time. Therefore, it's unsurprising, you don't register surprising events. It's as simple as that. If now we try and compensate for this imbalance, not by increasing the higher level precision, but by decreasing the lower level precision, so we're trying to bring things back into balance again, then what happens in this simulation is basically an hallucination, in the sense that there are no precise constraints upon the beliefs about the causes of your sensations anymore, because you've reduced the sensory precision. And then you basically, you're free running in terms of your explanations for sensory input, because there's nothing to explain, because you've made it imprecise. Now, if you're very quiet, you might hear the hallucination. Well, I heard it anyway. Okay, so let's move on quickly. This is Rick's work. He's not going to talk about this later on, so I'll talk about it. You're not, are you?
I wasn't going to talk about it in detail.
No. So I won't either, but at least it'll be an advert to some of his early work when he was a young man. So, last year. So the idea here, we're trying to understand abnormality of smooth pursuit eye movements, one of the other reproducible neurological, or at least measurable abnormalities in schizophrenia. And what we've done here is just create a little agent that tracks visually moving objects And it does so by, in its mind, imagining that there's some invisible attractor that's pulling both the target and the centre of gaze. And by virtue of the fact that the attractor is in advance of the target, it can anticipate where the target's going to be and thereby compensate for things like the sluggishness of the oculomotor response or indeed any other trajectory changes that have not actually yet occurred, thereby partly compensating for oculomotor delays. I won't go through the model in any more detail other than to say to use these simulations, we simply integrate or solve those differential equations that reduce the prediction error in the way that we described before. So up at the top, if you look at the little movie, what we have here is a target with the red dot, and the cross is the location of fixation. And crucially, the dot moves behind an occluder on the right-hand side. And the eye follows the target even when it's behind the occluder. And what we want to do is to examine the effects of changing precision on the effect of the occluder on the accuracy of the slow pursuit tracking. And why we're doing this? Well, because schizophrenic people typically show abnormal responses to occluders during the smooth pursuit eye movement paradigm. And indeed, if we break the balance by reducing high level or prior precision here, what we see is a profound difference in the tracking from this good tracking here to this odd tracking here. This is just the rate of change of position, so it's the eye velocity. And indeed, when we break the gain control at the higher level, this compensatory jump when the target re-emerges from the occluder actually exceeds a threshold that would normally be attributed or described as a compensation or a catch-up saccade. So this is a nice illustration of how simply one can reproduce another cardinal soft sign pure of schizophrenia purely on the basis of breaking the belief machinery, the information processing, again, by breaking or rendering the gain control, the precision, at high levels of the hierarchy. This is just another example. I'm just showing this because it's a nice movie. If you look at the target, what's happening here is that the subject or the simulated agent expects a smooth sinusoidal motion. But what we've actually done is, at one point, we've simply quickly reversed the direction of the target to see what would happen. And paradoxically, the schizophrenic simulated agent is actually better at tracking that paradoxical or unexpected switch in the direction. And it's obvious why, because they have weaker prior beliefs, so they're more sensitive, relatively speaking, to the visual information. So paradoxically, they're more immune to false beliefs of a predictive sort when they are not appropriate. And in this particular contrived example, the beliefs about continuous motion is not appropriate because we're deliberately changing the direction of the target. So finally, I want to give one more example and then conclude. And the example will try to sort of bring delusions into the story. And I'm going to base this on Harriet Brown Ney Feldman's work on sensory attenuation. So sensory attenuation is the phenomenon by which you attenuate the perceived intensity of sensations that you cause yourself. So this is, from the point of view of the predictive coding scheme, a reduction in sensory precision when you are the agent or the author of the sensations that are being caused. And there are good reasons why you'd have to do that in order to actually move. This sort of sensory attenuation is nicely illustrated in the force matching illusion. So this paradigm, you produce a force by pushing on your own, back of your own hand. And then you will generally perceive that force as being of a smaller intensity or less precise that relative to when somebody else produces the same force. So if somebody else pushed on the back of my hand, I'd feel that other person producing a greater or more precise or more intense force than if I did it. So what we've done here is just written down this Bayes optimal predictive coding generative model for movements and the predicted sensations you would get from applying forces. All very simple. We're not writing anything down other than sensory attenuation. So I believe that when I do it, I'm going to attenuate sensory precision as opposed to when somebody else does. It's an exogenous force here denoted by the V here applied to the, say, lever that's pushing on the back of the hand. So we can integrate this scheme. This is the sort of neurobiology. This, again, is our gain control mechanism, neuromodulatory system that is attenuating sensory, the precision of sensory prediction errors of a somatosensory sort here, when and only when I am the author of the four sensations. Exactly the same scheme before, exactly the same integration procedures, and this is the sort of behaviour that we get. So in the normal situation, this sensory let me just describe what this shows very briefly. These are the sensory predictions, the sort of proprioceptive force, the somatosensory products of registration of that pressure, the predictions and their prediction error in the dotted red lines here. These are the beliefs about me or you causing the force in terms of the amplitude of those forces. These are the Bayesian confidence intervals, the precision, if you like, posterior precision. And these are the hidden causes that something has come along and done something like that, or I am, or some other me force has caused these fluctuations in the states of the system generating the forces. And here's the action that is caused by the prediction error. So remember, action is enslaved by prediction errors reflexively to try and cancel prediction errors. And the reason that we're causing an action that is induced here by a prior belief that I will act through around the houses sort of way, through this cascade of predictions to produce a proprioceptive prediction error that then drives action. The reason that that works, the reason that I can actually move, is because I do not revise my beliefs about the fact that I am not moving. And the only reason I don't do that is that I'm attenuating the sensory prediction errors so that I'm obliging action to do all the heavy lifting in minimising the prediction errors. If I didn't do that, then I wouldn't move. And in fact, we can do that by removing the sensory precision. And now what happens is the prediction errors don't cancel themselves via the long route through action, or directly, sorry, through action. They cancel themselves by just revising beliefs that I'm not moving. So what would happen if we broke the precision in this instance? Well, first of all, how can we measure it? Well, here's the same sort of schematic or graphical report of the dynamics where we have a self-produced force sensation and an exogenous produced force sensation producing exactly the same force pressures. Now, we've just said because of sensory attenuation, it will be perceived as less when it's produced by oneself. That is just a fact of optimal Bayesian belief updating under sensory attenuation that is necessary to move. Conversely, if I, instead of perceiving an equal force as less, that means if I reproduce or tell an experimenter what level matched the force that I originally perceived, it would be reproduced as more. And this is basically the basis of the force matching illusion. That when you try to match a self-produced force in terms of an exogenously produced force, you always will always be reproduced as more. And one can look at that psychophysically. This is work from Suka Schergel at the IOP. So here's the veridic. This is the actual force, and this is the matched force. This is what normal subjects would do. They'd always believe that the they'd always overestimate the force necessary to reproduce the sensations that they cause themselves, and there's a shift, a vertical shift in this direction, and this is a force-matching illusion. Very robust finding. With people, in people who have schizophrenia, that illusion is attenuated. Again, they are paradoxically more veridical in their beliefs, in the sense that they are more resistant to illusory phenomena. And we can reproduce that almost exactly in our simulated patient, or normal subject here, and simulated patient, if and only if we remove the sensory attenuation but compensate for it by reducing, or in this instance actually increasing, so we have a failure of sensory attenuation, so now the sensory precision is too high, and again the higher level precision is too low, but now we're going to compensate by increasing the precision of the higher beliefs to reinstate action. But there are two consequences. First of all, we don't get the illusion, we have this failure of the force matching illusion, but more importantly, we induce a false belief, a delusion, that the exogenous force is acting in opposition to my believed consequences of my believed force. I won't go into details, well, in fact, I'll just summarise it in the next slide. But that has to happen in order to have high-level prediction errors that produce low-level prediction errors to produce action. You have to have delusions, false beliefs, in order to act. And that provides a simple, possibly not generalizable, but appealingly simple and principled explanation for very low-level delusory beliefs of this sort. And I've just tried to summarize the steps of the argument that derive not through just trying to thinking about the problem, but by actually simulating an inference scheme, information processing, in the context of breaking and then compensating for the balance of hierarchical gain or precision control. So, just to summarise, we act by predicting our actions to create attenuated prediction errors that are reflexively suppressed. A failure to attend of sensory attenuation or to attenuate the sensory prediction errors subverts our predictions and precludes action. And if we didn't compensate for that, we'd have psychomotor poverty. We just wouldn't move, because we'd always believe we weren't moving, and there'd be nothing, no evidence to counter that belief. If now we compensate for that failure of sensory attenuation, compensatory increases in prior precision reinstate unattenuated prediction errors, but because they're unattenuated, they can only be explained by external forces, and that one could look at as a metaphor for delusions of control and made acts. So, in summary, what we've done with those examples is to meet our agenda of going in there and trying to explain the genesis of false inference under the constraint that it has to, or it is likely to engage, a failure of neuromodulatory gain control, and explain both hallucinations and delusions, remember the bird song and the last example. But en route, we have also provided a sufficient explanation for attenuation of violation or mismatch negativity responses, loss of Gestalt, eye movement, abnormalities, psychomotor poverty, and this famous resistance to illusions. So an illustration of how one can use, in this instance, predictive coding as a computational framework to get into the anatomy, the computational anatomy of psychotic phenomenology. So what is the functional deficit? Well, we're saying it's a false inference due to aberrant coding of precision. What's the psychopathology? A neuromodulator failure of personal excitability, and there are a number of mechanisms that we could talk about and probably will talk about. What does that mean? Well, it means that we can model it, and therefore we can make predictions about observable brain responses using computational modelling, and we're going to hear a lot about that, choice behaviour, later on. For us, particularly in the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging, that leads, of course, to computational fMRI, and there'll be specific sessions on that for me and my colleagues. That also makes some strong predictions about the physiology of electrophysiological responses and fMRI responses that can be addressed with dynamic causal modelling. So with that, I will conclude, because I haven't been given my 5-minute sign, or have I, and I just didn't see it. Just on time. So I'd just like to thank all my collaborators and the people whose ideas that I've been talking about, but of course thank you for your attention. Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you very much indeed, Carl, for speaking so early in the morning. Do we have any questions?
They certainly have the form of a neural network. I wouldn't say they were standard, though. This is a very particular neural network that can be variously understood as a Bayesian filter or a predictive coding network. They have the look and feel, though, of standard